The Southern Roots Radio, WVLZ 1180 Knoxville, WKCE 1120 Maryville. Our special guest is with us today. It's kind of a little different from what we usually talk about, but trust me, we'll get on a little bit of politics in just a minute. Ron Miller is with us. He is the author of Escape from the Happy Cannibal. And Ron, welcome to The Voice.
Well, good morning. Thank you very much for having me
with
on the program.
With or without bite marks.
Yeah, you said it's good to have a happy cannibal, but remember, it's always better to invite a cannibal to dinner than the other way around.
Well, I thought it'd be better to have a full cannibal.
Yeah.
just been through the drive-thru at Taco Bell or something like that and is full up. What people are going to be saying, what in the world is this, where'd you get a title like that for a book? Tell us about the book to begin with.
Well, that's a good way to start. Every author would like a title that intrigues the potential readers, and you know, I hope that this title does that, but it also touches on the essence of the book. And basically the book covers 3.5 years of global travel. I've got a map here you might want to look at. It's just pretty much every corner of the world.
You just took off and just started roaming around.
Yeah, I sure did. Back when I was 29, I sold my house out in the suburbs and pretty much everything that went along with it.
Was there some outstanding warrants?
No.
You just decided to...
But when you look at this map...
Get a little wanderlust.
You're right, yeah. When you look at this map of where I've traveled, you kind of think, well, what's wrong with this fella? What's he running from, or what's he hiding from? But actually, I was looking for something, but at the time, I didn't realize it. I thought I was just traveling abroad to see the beautiful landscapes around the world, but I was drawn in because of what I was starting to learn about culture. And that, back to the title again, Escape from the Happy Cannibal, it touches on the essence of the book. As I traveled and began experiencing a lot of exotic cultures, I started to realize that culture is a tremendous influence on us human beings and collectively upon society. And I realized if I was born in India, I'd be a different Ron Miller.
Mm-hmm.
And if I was born in Brazil, I'd be a different person. And this disturbed me.
It's not even just that, you know. I mean, you're a different person in the United States. Obviously, a Southern culture has an effect. A Northern, New England culture. If you were born out west, all those things, where you're born, how you come up, it has a tremendous effect on you.
Absolutely, there are microcultures even within mainstream culture, but it disturbed me to realize that. When I was traveling abroad, I realized I was taking my culture with me, my cultural mm-hmm. perspectives. But I thought at that time I was sort of a combination of Clint Eastwood and John Wayne, my own mm-hmm. man, you know, self-made mm-hmm. man. I realized that I was to some extent a product of my culture. So I had to ask myself the ultimate question. If I was born in a society of cannibals, mm-hmm. would I question that society's values and behaviors, or would I just be a happy cannibal?
Mm-hmm.
And basically, this journey was my escape from the happy cannibal, you might say, which is to be more than the culture I would just happen to be mm-hmm. born into.
Mm-hmm. To still rise, if that culture is wrong, to rise above that culture and recognize right and wrong and make
absolutely, there has to be a source of guidance that should supersede culture,
mm-hmm.
because no culture is perfect. If it's true that we're born into a fallen world, we're born into a world of fallen culture, so we mm-hmm. should be more than the culture we just happen to be born into.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking for that guidance that should supersede culture.
Now, where did you start at?
United States.
Mm-hmm.
I was born here in Tennessee. Well, actually raised here in Tennessee, but traveled abroad. My first trip was your typical around-the-world journey, mm-hmm. as many college students will do after they've finally passed that hurdle and celebrate a bit. And I started out with more traditional travel through Europe and the places that we perceive here in the United States is much safer. But I started to travel and further trips, more exotic locations, because there was a greater cultural contrast and a greater opportunity to learn.
Now, when you started out, were you on one of these, you know, where you go to the travel agency and they book you on a plane and then that you get there and you're on a bus with everybody in the same hotel and you travel with the same people?
No, I always traveled pretty much individually. I realized early on when I wanted to see as much of the world as I could
mm-hmm.
and travel to those countries that I thought would welcome an American, that there weren't not tours set up mm-hmm. for that kind of travel. And I became more experienced by learning from other travels as I went abroad and realized that, hey, I can go into sub-Saharan Africa and India, places that I thought would be too risky, and it wasn't as dangerous as I initially thought.
You know, see if you agree with one of my theories, and I'm just talking about this could apply to the Smoky Mountains, the North Georgia Mountains, to Florida, anywhere within a 10-hour drive. But have we lost the art of travel? We now take vacations, and you get on a jet, and an hour later, you're somewhere. You don't see the changing of the culture. You don't see the changing of the geography. You don't see that. You don't ease into anything. You're just there. And it just doesn't seem the same to me.
Well, there is one thing I noticed as I started to travel. There's sort of two different tourists. Basically, it's tourists and travelers. And the travelers will sort of tend to look down on tourists. But if you look at it objectively, you realize that tourists, they have a very limited amount of time and quite a bit of money, and they're looking for the comforts of home most often when they travel. Whereas a traveler wants to dive into the local culture. Mm-hmm. And when you get out there and you start backpacking, you realize that travelers are very frugal. They don't have much money and lots of time, but they are interested to learn about the cultures, the local cultures, as much as they can. And and they're You definitely see that, but I don't look down on either travelers or tourists.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything. It just seems like we've lost a little bit of that art. I know I'm just going to Florida, I get on the back roads and I stop in the little towns and I visit and I try to eat in the little towns and visit with some folks and just look around at their downtown or whatever it is. And I know some people are just, we've got to be there in 8 hours. I've got the clock. This is how long a AAA says it ought to make it. We got to stay on the interstate. We can't get off. I guess, you know, in a minor way, I guess in my mind, we've lost a little. I'm not sure. It's certainly not the same as what you're talking about, but it seems to be schedule important rather than experience important.
I agree with that. And I changed my travel patterns here in the United States. If I don't need to get somewhere in a hurry, I'll take the back roads, and just as you stay, say you'll stop in a local mom-and-pop store, you'll meet some interesting folks and learn a little bit about the cultural differences that you might see crossing the border, or definitely get up into the mountains where some of my folks are from.
When you started that, after you went through, like you said, the typical trip where there's folks are friendly to America, where did you mention a minute ago that you went that you were afraid that it was going to be hostile to Americans?
Well, I was concerned traveling into sub-Saharan Africa, for instance, or Indians, Vietnam, places like that, where you thought, where I perceived there might be a lot of animosity toward Americans. But I really didn't. That wasn't my experience. I was very well received nearly everywhere I went.
And you're basically, am I right about this? You basically have a backpack on and you're on foot.
That's exactly right. And I always would try to travel the mode of transport that would allow me to meet the locals as much as possible. I did a lot of hitchhiking, which, while I never perceived I'd be hitchhiking throughout so much of the world, but when you get into the less expensive countries, you jump on a train, you're right there with the people. But I was never in my own car traveling that way.
You say the less expensive countries and everything. Where are those at? I mean, you know, people here, when they think about going on a vacation overseas, they think of London. Calvin's been to London. You didn't find that very inexpensive, did you, Calvin?
No, not at all. Not at all.
And how was the food, by the way?
I would not recommend the bangers and mash.
I'm assuming that you probably have to be pretty adventurous as far as what you eat and where you stay, obviously.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. As I look back upon my travels now, I would have been definitely frightened to have taken off if I knew what I would eventually get into, like I say, hitchhiking and some of the countries I was visiting during times of revolution. But it was a tremendous learning opportunity, and at the time, in the not so distant past, Americans, they did have a safeguard, because in our country we looked after Americans abroad, and I think we're losing that a little bit. And if I were to travel now, I'd be a little bit more hesitant, especially in certain countries.
I was going to ask you that. The what I guess what I would think is you're going around and you're looking at all these countries, meeting all these people, obviously with preconceived notions. What type of effect did it have on you as a person? I mean, were you a different person when you got back from these travels?
Oh, absolutely. As I said, I initially thought I was traveling simply to see the beautiful landscapes, but what I realized is that what left the greatest impact was the people that I was meeting. And I was very much touched by their selflessness and their hospitality, and I started to appreciate people much more. It changed me from that standpoint. There's a quote from Helen Keller that I think really touches upon that, and her quote is that the most beautiful things in the world cannot be seen or touched, but are felt in the heart. And that was pretty much the lesson that I learned, and especially staying with relatives. I went to Ukraine back when it was still within the Soviet bloc, and I arrived fearing that my relatives would possibly shun me, because you can just imagine the kind of anti-American propaganda that they must have been exposed to. But the outpouring of hospitality taught me that humanity can trump ideology. It was probably the strongest, most influential experience of my travels.
And when was that?
That was back in August of 1991, during the coup. I was in the Soviet Union at that time, and I arrived in Ukraine just after the coup.
So ideology, Soviet ideology or communist ideology, was starting to fall away anyway to a certain extent with some of those folks.
It was,
but they probably still had a real distrust of Americans, I would think.
No, I don't.
You don't think so?
No, they didn't have a distrust of Americans. Actually, it was a tremendous lesson. You're talking about politics. I love politics, by the way. But at that time in the Soviet Union, what surprised me when I first arrived in Moscow in Russia was the outspokenness of the people. You know, with perestroika and glasnost, the people were transitioning from fearing the government under the Great Terror, under Stalin, to where they were emboldened. And even more so than I recall in the United States at the time, they were vilifying Gorbachev, who was kind of looked upon by a lot of folks favorably here. But what I saw was that transition from the people fearing their government to the government fearing the people. And then with the revolution there, that's how that came about, and that was a very powerful learning lesson to see that.
And you have relatives over there.
Yes, in Ukraine. And because the Soviet Union was very centralized and people moved about quite a bit, I had relatives in Russia and Uzbekistan throughout that area, but I had not communicated with them. As you can imagine, growing up here in the United States during the Cold War, that was something to not to celebrate, but really to hide, that you had relatives in Soviet Union. And so I arrived completely unannounced on their doorstep, and I didn't know how I'd be received, but it was a tremendous...
How did you know they were there?
Yes.
How did
yes.
you know they were there?
Well, my grandparents immigrated from Ukraine back in the late 20s.
Oh, okay.
And they were living in Canada, so they're quite distant, but my father, of
course, did you have to prove
Ukrainian.
To them that you were cousin or something?
How it worked out. The only thing I had as far as contact, I had a picture of one relative, one of my father's first cousins, and his address. And I was so fortunate to meet someone that spoke English when I arrived in the city of Rovno, and they just volunteered to escort me around, and it would not have been the same trip without someone to interpret. But when I arrived, he was very skeptical. And as you can imagine, just in the Soviet Union back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, just having a relative overseas could get you into a gulag. And if you're actually communicating with them, that's a serious offense. But times were changing, but still he had that in the back of his mind. He was an elderly gentleman. And not until I showed him the picture of himself, I could just see the concern drop off of his face.
I can imagine. So you just showed up unannounced.
Just absolutely unannounced, that's right.
How did you deal with the language barrier? I see that, you know, just by looking at the map, you're just basically all over the place.
Yeah.
And I know you're not a polyglot, are you?
No, I speak a little bit of Russian, which is similar to Ukrainian, and also some Spanish. But it's an interesting thing, because sometimes I'll look back. For instance, I was in China just as it was opening up to outsiders. I was one of the first travelers to go in and be able to move around somewhat freely. So I was in villages where they had never seen an outsider. and they never saw anybody so different, so ugly, mm-hmm. you might say. Mm-hmm. And I'd have entire villages following me around. I think, well, how am I managing to get my bus tickets and get food in the restaurants? And when I look back, I realize that, well, if you go into a restaurant, you're not going in there to buy a car. You're going in there to get food. So mm-hmm. it's kind of natural. And in China, for instance, I had a phrase book that I could show them, okay, here's what I want. But if they couldn't read, then I would just point to someone else's meal that looked mm-hmm. good, or mm-hmm. I'd just go back in the kitchen and point at the food.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing with...
I thought all Chinese restaurants were buffets. I didn't...
Not over there.
Is there Chinese food like what we get over here?
No, it's not.
I've heard that from everybody.
There's no General Joe's chickens over there?
No. But it probably will change. You know, I think it's a country that's becoming westernized very quickly, and they'll probably start to see some buffets and things like that there. But typically, when you're served a meal, you go into a restaurant, you didn't have that much choice, and I oftentimes didn't know what I was eating. But
mm-hmm. you see, that's my big fear. I've always wanted to do some traveling like that, but what has always been a barrier for me is the financial. Is he going to stay?
He's staying.
Okay,
you're staying, aren't you?
Oh, definitely.
This is Johnny Cash.
I want to talk a little bit about that when we come back.
I've been everywhere. We'll dedicate that to Ron Miller. Johnny Cash at 546-2148. You're tuned to The Voice on Southern Roots Radio.
I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere.
We've got Ron Miller with us. He is the author of Escape from the Happy Camel. I'm trying to read that upside down. See, when I first saw the book, I didn't see the top part, and I thought it was just The Happy Cannibal. Escape from the Happy Cannibal by Ron Miller. And I think Kelvin has some questions. So.
Well, I've always wanted to kind of do some worldwide traveling, but finance has always been a barrier for me. How did you do this? I know you said you sold your house, but, I presume all your worldly possessions.
I left on my first trip. I thought I would be gone about 4 or 5 months because I thought that's as far as my finances would go. But what I didn't realize, when you get into the third world countries, I think it's because their currency is devalued because they're dictators. They go and put all their money in the Swiss bank or something like that. But anyway, as an example, when I was in Ukraine, the ruble was just dropping out. I could stay in the nicest hotel in Rovno for $1 a night. And that's
how nice was the hotel?
Well, it was.
Wait, like it's a Motel 6, it's a Super 8. There's
a motel bathroom.
Yeah, a Motel 6 from 1900. How about
okay.
that?
Okay.
Well, I was about to say book me, but go ahead.
But the same thing when you travel in India and in the third world countries, it's very very inexpensive. You can oftentimes a traveler can get around on $10 a day, and that includes mm-hmm. your travel expenses, your motel, your food.
But when you say $10 a day or $1 a day, are you talking about, did you take regular American currency, or do you have to stop somewhere like at a little toll booth and swap it? How's that work?
Well, it's much easier today than it was back then. When you got into a third world country, let's use Nepal as an example, I would have to take in traveler's checks. And traveler's checks I could cash in almost any town within the country. But these days, they're probably accepting credit cards. It's much easier to travel. But, yeah, I'm always talking in terms of dollars with the exchange rate. But $10 a day in a lot of countries, you can live pretty comfortably
now,
and
you,
do a lot.
Are you staying in hotels most of the time, or are you sleeping outside sometime?
In the Western countries where it was expensive, I would stay in hostels and, mm-hmm. and type of setups where Kelvin mentioned sharing bathrooms and so forth. And sometimes you're in a more like a military barracks where you've got snorers and things mm-hmm. to deal with. But when you get into the third world countries, you can get your own motel room, and oftentimes it's quite comfortable. And the locals, even though you're spending a little bit of money, it's a lot of money to them, and you see the free market at work. It's mm-hmm. it's a enlightening experience.
Well, you were telling us. Oh, go ahead, Rick. I'm sorry.
No, before we jump continents too much, I was curious about your visit to Russia and Moscow. Did you encounter, I mean, this is before the change, you might say. Did you encounter officials that kind of roughed you up a little, checked you over?
Actually, that happened to him when he got here today. Yeah. That's our security system.
I was just curious, like, when you were touring, what could you actually, what would they allow you to do?
Well, it didn't match my preconceptions when I traveled in the Soviet Union. I had to travel the first time with a tour. That was the only way you could move about the Soviet Union. And I really thought that the KGB is watching us at every moment. But oftentimes we get into
they're
towns.
They're too busy trying to find their own work.
Yeah. We get into each new city, and we would expect that we would expect that the KGB would be there watching over us, but a lot of times there would be nobody there to come pick us up because they didn't want to work. And that was...
So how did you... Walk me through, you know, leaving Knoxville. I mean, did you just go down to McGee Tyson and hop a plane to Nepal? I mean, how did this...
Well, the first trip I had an around-the-world airline ticket, and it...
Which is... And for those of us who are not world globe-trotting travelers.
You can still purchase those, which is typically a combination of air carriers, a U.S. air carrier, a European, and an Asian air carrier, which will get you around the world. And as long as you
move... I mean, just one ticket? Or
It's open. It's a bit open, but as long as you progress around the world sort of latitudinally or longitudinally, you can make various stops. And there are certain limitations, but... It's somewhat flexible, and I don't travel that way anymore because I wanted to have more liberty. And I was about to say this earlier, and
how much
went
one of
off
those things
on a,
cost you?
What's that?
How much one of those things cost you? Can I get one today?
You can probably get one today for about the same price as 15 years ago the first time, and I think it was about. You can get them for about $2,000.
Really?
Yeah, they're very inexpensive.
But Lloyd.
My first trip, I thought I was...
Handle it.
Yeah. My first trip, I thought I was going to be gone for only about 5 months because I thought my finances would run out. But I ended up traveling a full year. And the only reason I came back is because that the restrictions on that airline ticket is good for 1 year. And my last leg was from New Zealand back to the States. And if you have any idea how cheap I am, you know I wouldn't pick up another ticket from New Zealand.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned something off microphone during the break that I think is kind of fascinating. I've heard this actually from other people, not that has traveled as extensively as you, but you left here a liberal.
Yes.
And came back a conservative.
That's right. I fit the quote from Winston Churchill just to the T, and see if I can remember it. Any man who's less than 30 and is not a liberal has no heart, and any man who is older than 30 and is not a conservative has no brains. And I left the United States when I was 29, and I came back at 30 years old from my first trip. And I realized that the liberal policies, ideology, it sounds sweet, but it doesn't work. Spent some time in a communist country where there's no incentive to work harder and longer, and the first thing you recognize is that the people become very skilled at avoiding work. And My travels through a lot of impoverished countries and socialist countries has shown me that ideology doesn't work, and I've become a very right-wing conservative.
Yeah, just out of curiosity, how do you feel about this current immigration situation? I mean, you obviously have a pretty much of a marginally socialist state in Mexico, and people are coming over here. There's some people coming over here to sell drugs, but there's also people coming over here to work and try to make life better and everything. At the same time, I got to tell you, I'm one of those folks that just believe I believe in state sovereignty. I believe in national sovereignty, and I don't know how you have national sovereignty without borders, without some type of control of borders, not necessarily borders that are shut down. But how do you feel about that?
I probably agree with you in most points on the immigration. I definitely want to see us control our borders and control immigration. We need to control who we want to come in here. And what I see is the greatest concern is not people coming in, and now we're going to have eat more tacos and mm-hmm. and be exposed to Spanish. But what I saw in Mexico that taught me another valuable lesson is that the people there fear their government, their police. I was in a small village, and I was just trying to find someone that invited me to their home. And I eventually ended up at the police station. So I'm walking with the police chief. It was a mm-hmm. very unusual situation. There I was with the police chief and me, a gringo in shorts and sandals. And this police chief was a bit like Saddam Hussein Espanol. Mm-hmm. You know, he had the big gut and mm-hmm. and he walked around with a lot of hubris. But when I walked beside him, I had the opportunity to see the locals when they first caught a glimpse of him. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't, oh, there's the police there to protect us.
It wasn't Andy Griffith yes, walking down
yes.
the street.
They were afraid of him. And what I fear about immigration is if you get too large a mass of people coming into this country and they're not enculturated, that they will fear their leaders. They won't hold our leaders accountable. And mm-hmm. that's where you get tyranny. And if we get mm-hmm. a tyrannical society, we've lost the United States of America. Mm-hmm.
That's a very interesting take on it.
I don't know if this is something that you've looked into, but there's this organization called the International Republican Institute. You're familiar with them?
No, I've heard of that one.
What they do is they go around the world to emerging democracies and basically help to build their political system and build political parties and show how to, you know, modern campaign techniques and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And I'm not really sure where I'm going with this or anything, but in terms of marrying your travel experiences and your interest in politics, is that something that, because I've been kind of looking at this myself, mm-hmm. you know, how involved in politics did you get during your other, just as an observer?
Yeah, that's the word that was coming to mind as you were asking that question. I was the observer, standing back, and I didn't feel it was my role to step in mm-hmm. necessarily, although I would always share my values. But the most important thing I learned in traveling is that you will not have a just society simply by having just laws. You know, we have a good example here in the United States. We have laws that make it illegal for foreigners to be here illegally, but we don't enforce those mm-hmm. laws. And it's also another point is that we oftentimes think that the problems with tyrannical societies are these tyrants at the top. And Saddam Hussein is a good example. We thought, well, we removed Saddam Hussein, mm-hmm. and they're going to have United States of America in the Middle East. But actually, Saddam Hussein, as we all know now, is merely a symptom of the problem. And the problem is actually living in the people of that society. So,
you know, I think about that is just simply that, historically, you can't give anybody freedom. At some point, they have to take it for themselves.
Yeah, you have to have a large enough critical mass of people within a society that understand what justice is and hold their leaders accountable. And as soon as you lose that, then you'll have a tyrant rise to power.
And I've got to ask Kelvin, so why in the world would we want to import modern political techniques to the rest of the world?
Export it to them.
Export it, I'm sorry.
I don't know.
And plus, why are we trying to export democracy when we're a republic and not a democracy? I've always wondered about that too.
That's another topic for another day.
Just throw that at you there.
But anyway, I want to ask you about some of these countries here that Bogota, Colombia.
Bogota, yes.
Yeah. Did you make it to Colombia?
Yes, I traveled through Colombia, and that's probably a city that I was the most concerned about walking around. Almost without exception, when I arrive in a city, I go walking around to get mm-hmm. a feel for the city. And what was interesting about Bogota is that right in the central area, every street corner had a police officer, military, I don't know what they were, but they had a machine gun. Mm-hmm. And you felt secure because there was law enforcement. But as soon as you got away from the city center a little bit, I didn't understand it initially. I started to feel a little less secure, and I realized, well, there are no no military or policemen mm-hmm. standing around with machine guns. And there's another city where I was very well received by the locals, but I was a bit concerned walking around Bogota.
Jakarta, Indonesia.
Jakarta. The thing I remember about Jakarta was the Pizza Hut. I had traveled already through Sumatra, and when I got into Jakarta, I hadn't had Western food. And as I say, one of the most dangerous places to be overseas is between a homesick American and the nearest McDonald's. It's an amazing thing where you may not even frequent fast food at home, but when you see it overseas after you've been away from
your home cooking. Yeah, I was really disturbed. If y'all have seen this color photograph, where is this? In China. There's that creepy Ronald McDonald sitting there. Who gives me the creeps over here, but you know, I bet you're right. If you hadn't seen anything American for a while, it would be kind of comforting.
Well, I know you were talking a little bit
but,
about
you know,
food couldn't
morning. You get a better wardrobe, really? Let's just be honest about that.
You were talking about food this morning, and yeah, you'll get, I don't know, it's like eating a little bit at home. You get mm-hmm. you get a little homesick. But the reason I put that picture in there of Ronald McDonald, for those that obviously can't see the picture, it's a picture of a Chinese family with their young son sitting in the bench where you can get a picture with a full-size replica of Ronald McDonald. And as soon as I saw that was the first McDonald's, and it had just opened in Beijing when I was there. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I saw that, I realized that, hey, that he's a clandestine capitalist, our Ronald McDonald. Mm-hmm. But as soon as the kids get a taste for the Happy Meal, it's all over for the communists.
I remember the day that they opened up Letterman City. They broke all kinds of records. They sold, you know, I don't know what it was, a ton of potatoes, you know, 600 pounds of buns and a pound and a half of ground beef.
Sudan.
Sudan. I didn't get to Sudan.
Didn't get to Sudan.
Didn't get to Sudan. And probably won't for a while.
Yeah. Mongolia?
Mongolia. That was my most recent overseas trip. And it was a fairly short visit. But I was astonished at how much they love the United States of America in Mongolia. And I think it might be as a result of a lot of our aid organizations that go in there. But that is a very capitalistic oriented society. They're in the capital of Ulaanbaatar. The reason it surprised me so much is there it is sandwiched in between Russia and China, but they really had an affinity for Americans there.
Yeah, look at some of your chapter titles, and they're very intriguing, and I'm just going to throw a few out and let you comment on what happens in that chapter. Finding trust in the desert.
Finding trust in the desert.
Yeah, that's in the Middle East. That's in Egypt.
That's
actually.
Egypt. That was early on in my travels. And one thing I was, well, I had just left Turkey and Israel. But in Turkey, I was quite naive when I first started traveling. And you go abroad as an American, we live in a society where things are rather controlled. But you get into the Middle Eastern countries, and really part of their culture, if you can take advantage of someone, then it's kind of accepted. It's mm-hmm. it's the way things are there. But in Turkey, I was swindled, and I was having a hard time dealing with that because of my gullibility. I didn't want to see how gullible I was. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as Americans, we're quite trusting. And you certainly learn that you need to not always be quite so trusting. You need to be
swindled
a little bit more
how?
Discriminating.
Swindled how?
Well, I was trying to get from the Turkish mainland down to Cyprus, and my guidebook pretty much ended in Turkey, so I didn't have a lot of information there. And I went in the city of Antalya, went to several travel agencies and ferry companies trying to find out if I could get across to Antalya. And I think that a gentleman overheard me. Let's just call him my friend, because mm-hmm. that's how he introduced himself, as my friend.
Yeah, that's a good sign there that
yeah,
you need to watch.
Yeah, yeah. All my emails that come from overseas.
yeah.
My
friend.
Start out with my, but I didn't mean to interrupt
yeah,
you.
But he obviously overheard me in one of the places I was looking for information. And he just worked me over very well. He said, oh, I'm going to Cyprus and then on to Israel, which is what I wanted to do. And he said the boat is leaving in the next day and so forth. And what was interesting is I had to get money in advance to pay for this phantom boat. And I had this wad of Turkish, what do they have, lira, I believe it's Turkish lira, in my pocket. And I was feeling guilty because I was keeping it from him. Because he had said that he had paid for this ticket with his credit card. And, of course, you know, he was, mm-hmm. he was making all that up. But it was that identifying with him and that empathy that I had, which has gone away, by the way. I no longer have that. I learned a good lesson. But I felt guilty for not trusting him. And as soon as I gave him the money, he was gone.
Now, how about the monkey conspiracy?
The monkey conspiracy. Well, it was...
Now, we're very interested in monkeys here for some reason. Yeah, we really don't know why, but we think they come in here at night and mess with our equipment.
Yeah. Well, that was traveling through Indonesia, Sumatra, Java, and Bali. And one of the most memorable experiences there was going into the rehabilitation center in Sumatra, city of Bukit Luang, where they take orphaned orangutans and they try and reintroduce them into the jungle. And what I did, I went with several other travelers. We walked several miles into the jungle to a feeding platform. And when we arrived, there was not a single orangutan to be seen, but they come in as almost as if they have an internal clock to get some bananas and coconut milk to sort of sustain mm-hmm. them until they learn how to get their sustenance from the jungle. But it was a powerful experience because, unlike monkeys that run through the trees, they're very methodical in the way that they mm-hmm. move through the forest. It's like a ballerina and a chess player all at once. And when they actually sat down on this feeding platform, they were as civilized, if not more civilized, than children. And it was quite powerful to see how intelligent these creatures are.
Once again, we are speaking with Ron Miller. He is the author of Escape from the Happy Cannibal, A Journey of the Soul, and I want to talk a little bit about that when we come back. Can you hang with us? We're going to try Carl Perkins doing Restless one more time. We had some highly technical problems out there. Somebody pulled a plug out before. We'll be back. Kelvin Moxley, Vic King, I'm Lloyd Daugherty.
Restless. I need to get on out of town. I need to go right now. Take me where the living's easy, baby. That's where I'll be.
Ron Miller's with us. He has written Escape from the Happy Cannibal. And I know, Kelvin, you had some more questions.
Well, if somebody were wanting to do what you've done, what sort of advice would you give them, you know, how to get started and what to look for and
good shoes.
Yeah.
Extra socks. Am I right?
If you wanted to travel as a backpacker, a good, comfortable backpack, that's very essential. You want to pack as light as possible, but actually there are tremendous resources out there on the Internet. If you just do world travel, do a search, you find so much information, whereas when I first started traveling before the Internet, I was meeting some other travelers and learning as I went. But
did you mentioned a tour guide. Is there any particular brand? I mean, there's several brands of tour guides.
They're actually about the only thing you need is a good guidebook. And mm-hmm. I use Lonely Planet guidebooks. Mm-hmm. And it caters to the backpacker. It gives you all the information you need about the country, everything from safety, security, visas, where you might want to go, and get great information on history of the country and what to expect from the people. It pretty much covers everything for the backpacker. And there are other guides out there that cater more to if you want to stay in a comfortable hotel and spend a little bit more money.
So how did you travel when you were there? I mean, backpacker, you think, you know, somebody walking down the road, and from looking at your map, apparently you didn't walk the whole way. I know you're not like Lamar Alexander or anything, but I mean, I'm just curious.
Did you have a flannel shirt for you? Huh?
But did you hop a train? Did you do a little taxiing? Did you get in one of these things where some guy grabs the front end and, like, runs down the street, and you're riding like Kramer on Seinfeld?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you travel once you got there within an area, especially maybe a third world type country?
Yeah. Of course, it depends on the country. In Europe, most people will get a rail pass, possibly something of that nature. But I ended up doing a lot of hitchhiking. I became quite addicted to that because, first of all, I'm cheap, so there's a free ride. Mm-hmm. But actually, it was the fact that you meet already a sort of a select group. It's people with empathy. People want to learn about yourself, where you're from. So I traveled quite often, especially in the Western countries, by hitchhiking. And then when you get into the third world countries, jump on a train, it's hardly even an expense. It's so inexpensive, but you're right there with a lot of the local folks. That was always my goal, my desire was to meet as many of the local folks as possible.
Was hitchhiking safer there than it would be in America?
Yeah, see, that in itself bothers me.
Yeah, I don't recommend hitchhiking, of course. I really don't, but it was part of my adventure, and I write about why I think I was so drawn to it. But my first experience hitchhiking, I never hitchhiked in the United States. You know, I always thought, well, that's for the
fools
down and out. Yeah, you know, last resort for the down and out. But I was just arrived in Europe, and I was in England, and I was traveling with a young lady from East Germany, which that was a cultural experience there, to spend time with someone that grew up in an isolated communist country like that. But she had no money. As you can imagine, the East German drachma back in 1991 had no value outside of East Germany. So she had...
And very little inside.
Yeah, probably so. Little to buy there as well. But we wanted to travel up to the mountains up in Scotland. And, of course, my guidebook said there's no public transportation there. And she said, oh, Ron, it's not a problem. We will hitch a hike. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was kind of leery of that, as Vic was just saying. But I wouldn't dare express my concern. You know, Clint Eastwood wouldn't be afraid to hitchhike. So we get up in the countryside, just beautiful, lush countryside. And I'm wondering how she's going to get the attention of the first vehicle that comes along. There weren't many there. It was very rural. And I thought, well, is she going to... just hope the motorist stops or put her thumb out. But she was much more bold than that. In her East German form of hitchhiking, she actually stepped out in the middle of this one-lane road and was waving her arms over her head. And believe me, that East German form of hitchhiking worked very well.
You know, I've never had a great... I love traveling through the South. I love going to little towns and meeting folks and hanging out. I've done, I guess, since I was a little boy. I had some lung problems early on, and doctor said, take me to Florida. And of course, that was, we'd go through Georgia sometimes, Alabama sometimes, and I always enjoyed meeting those folks. But I've always wanted to go to Scotland and Ireland and Alaska. Now, were you in those places?
I'm ashamed to say I haven't been to Ireland as of yet, but I will get there. But yeah, I've traveled extensively through Alaska and a little bit in Scotland. It was a quick trip, but beautiful countryside, and it's easy to relate to the people. Alaska, what I came in with there was the independence, the independent mindset of the people. It is really
that's a
strong
frontier.
Yes,
yeah. I mean, they still have the frontier spirit. There, we're going to go to the phones. Daryl, good morning. How are you doing today?
I'm fine, Lloyd. I hope you and Kelvin are doing okay, and Ron and Vic.
Oh, we're just hanging out talking today. Kind of took a little step aside from our usual, give the politicians a break part of the day. But don't worry, top of the hour, I'm going to start on them again.
Well, I listen to you a lot, and I'm sure you'll get right back on the horse there soon. I'm a friend of Ron's, and I've talked with Ron since he's been back. We worked together at Flint Engineering years ago, and I think Ron recognized me.
I recognize the voice. How you doing, Daryl?
I'm doing fantastic, Ron. You're sounding good, coming through good, and Lloyd, those guys are asking some good questions this morning.
Well, you know, it's fascinating. I mean, you know, one of the things that I've always loved doing, it's kind of funny, but you remember when they used to have the travel logs, and you could go to the Tennessee Theater and see the travel logs?
Mm-hmm.
Or the Travel Channel now is basically just people doing bungee jumping, unfortunately, but occasionally they'll have something on there that's but I've always...
Or playing poker. What does that have to do with travel?
Yeah, I have no idea what that's about. I'm still confused about that one. I think I've got something wrong with my satellite. But, I've always loved those kind of things, and I've always bought books fiction books for that very reason and everything. So I always, like I said, it's weird. The only place I've ever really wanted to go myself with a great desire is Scotland, Ireland, and Alaska. But I think you could ask questions of him all day long with his.
Oh, he's full. He's got the. Yeah, I mean, if you've never traveled and I've been like to Canada and Mexico and just on the border towns and where I've traveled some there in the United States. But if just listening to Ron this morning, and talked with him through the years, that I think with his extensive travel and his knowledge, he just takes you through it with his eyes, you know. And that's important. So he's coming through well on the radio to people that haven't been to these places.
As soon as I heard your voice, Daryl, what I was thinking about is, of course, we worked at Flint Engineering back before I ever started traveling, and at that time I had no inkling or thought that I would travel like this. It's really quite strange looking back, but I do understand why I was motivated to go overseas and travel. I took a brief ski trip to Europe, and I was fascinated by the cultures there in Europe, traveling to a couple of different countries, but also met a young lady that was from Denver, Colorado, at a seminar, and she was telling me about her trip. She was about to quit her job and take a sabbatical and travel for 7 months visiting friends overseas, and I thought, you can do that? You know, it wasn't even in my realm of possibility, so that kind of planted a seed, and next thing I know, the house that I thought was security and everything that I wanted, I looked at it as an anchor tying me down, and without really sitting down and thinking about it, there I sold it, and the next thing I knew, all I had was a backpack and a round-the-world ticket, and there I went.
You know, folks, I'd love to do that.
Folks think they have security. I can see, Kevin, you're like me. You're going to want to go to the five-star
hotel. Come on. I stayed at the Econo Lodge. You remember the hotels I stayed at when I came to visit?
Well,
I want to say this to Ron and to the listeners, too. And like I said, I've known Ron a long time. And when he says he left the liberal and I think came back conservative, is so true. And also in his religion, we never talk about religion very much at our work and things. And now I think since he's been back, we've talked a lot about it. And I was raised Baptist and now Presbyterian. And it's funny that your guest on Tuesdays is John Stewart. That's my pastor. And
really? Is it?
Yeah, a fantastic man, another smart man, and I don't seem like I'm drawn to these people, and I just enjoy their stories and their knowledge, and Ron certainly, you know, fits the bill, and I just, to hear Ron and about religion and what he's learned and through, you know, the different, cultures is very, very important to me and makes me grow, you know, in my faith.
Well, thank you, Daryl. And imagine I got all that for only $20. $100 what I could have gotten.
That's right.
We'll give you 20 minutes to cut that out.
And Daryl, I appreciate you. Go ahead.
I want to say one other thing. I want John, Ron maybe touch before we leave on the one about in the book. I've read it certainly, and the one, the caning episode there. And it was on our national radar for a while. So, Ron, I'll be in touch with you. If you can just touch on that real quick, and I'll hang up and listen.
Right, and Daryl, I appreciate it because I was going to ask next about it affected your politics and how it affected your faith. But this, were you there when the caning episode?
Did he say caning or Cheney?
I thought he said caning.
I'm not sure.
I thought he said Cheney.
Cheney.
I'm sorry.
Well,
which
what he might be talking
was that?
About, when I was in Israel.
Because I was hoping it was a good caning story. Because I can't get enough caning stories. You were with me there, Vic.
I've got that story, too. That's in the book, the Singapore caning, because it was a very interesting place to visit to see such modernity and orderliness and cleanliness there in Singapore, right in the middle of Southeast Asia, where most of the other capitals are open sewers and there's no concept of throwing refuse in a garbage can. It's just out there on the street. And it really showed me how important, how significant good laws are.
Mm-hmm.
And I write about the caning of the American that was spray painting cars. Some street signs in his apartment or wherever he was living. And, you know, the United States at that time was frowning upon that, how barbaric that you would actually have corporal punishment. Mm-hmm. And I did in the book, I did a comparison of Singapore and Los Angeles, both cities being demographically quite similar. They're multiracial, about the same size, and they're both quite affluent, similar there. Whereas, you know, in Singapore, there was no graffiti to be found anywhere. Whereas you go to Los Angeles, and graffiti is an accepted form of art there now. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't even punish that. And I could walk anywhere safely in Singapore, even at night, whereas in Los Angeles, some places I probably wouldn't even be safe during the day. But the most significant difference is that in Singapore, the year of the caning, I think there were 58 murders, which is tragic. But in Los Angeles, there were well over 1,000 murders. So you have to ask which society is actually barbaric.
I was going
to
ask you, which place did you feel the safest in?
I felt very safe in Singapore. Any of the Scandinavian countries absolutely felt safe. And the people walk about, do their own business. You never got any strange stares. But I guess a lot of places I felt safe. A few places I didn't feel so safe. Mm-hmm. Bogota being one of them.
Mm-hmm. But reason enough to bring caning back, don't you think?
Yes.
I just, you know,
why did it ever go away?
Well, liberals.
Favorite caning of all time, Kelvin, in Congress.
Oh, we're all for caning now that we've grown up and gone beyond spray painting.
Preston Brooks and Charles Sunder.
Exactly.
No, that's not Sunder Wells.
Yeah. No, that's some of these guys we have on here, that's what we ought to try to encourage them to promote if they really want to get elected.
Yeah.
We need to bring back caning. But I know we're sort of jumping off subject.
I'm just looking
for future guests.
We need a professional caner in there. If you know of one, call us.
I'm just looking at these around the world plane trip fares. Mm-hmm. Pretty doggone reasonable.
Kelvin, let's go shopping for a backpack for Kelvin.
I swear, you know, next time you go, give me a call.
Okay.
I got my passport. It's valid, ready to roll. I can probably scrape together a few bucks and.
He will carry your backpack next time.
Well, he can definitely hire me as a guide. I'm available for that.
There you go.
But, I was looking at this one. It's, from, you know, about, $1,200. Los Angeles, Beijing, Bangkok, Hong Kong, Tokyo, Osaka, and back to Los Angeles.
That's sort of around the Pacific, which is a lot of traveling for that amount of money.
Yeah,
definitely.
And there's another one. It's about $2,500. New York, Tahiti, New Zealand, Sydney, Johannesburg, London, and back to New York.
But why don't you, before you launch out on this, take it. Why don't you walk down to Von Orr and just see how it works out? Because I'm a little worried about you getting on.
Well, how about London, Kentucky? And,
yeah, London, Kentucky.
Rome, Georgia.
Exactly. Let's go to Brian. Brian, good morning. How you doing today?
Good morning. Enjoying the backpacking stories and the travel stories.
Mm-hmm.
Done a little bit of that myself, not to the extent of your guest, though. But let me tell you, if you make it to Ireland, it is very easy to hitchhike there. That's how most of the teenagers get around to this day.
Do you stand in the middle of the road and wave your arms over your head?
No, not anything that drastic.
Well, the cars are as big as they are here, so, you know, if you get hit, you'll probably survive.
Yeah, unless it's
Don't try that when I'm driving the Roadmaster. That's all I've got to say.
Yeah. Well, I don't think you get that Roadmaster on an Irish street.
No, I don't think it fits.
And the vision of any one of you guys out there with a backpack with your thumb out, I just can't picture that.
Yeah, see, I'm having this trouble with Kelvin, too, and don't you think you ought to try it to Von Orr first, or maybe Newport? I don't know.
Well,
Yeah, he could come up La Follette.
Yeah, go up.
Well, maybe
mountains.
He and I could race.
Yeah,
you know, I get on one exit going, you know, and see which one of us gets picked up. I bet it would be him. you know, between the two of us.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, that's a perfectly acceptable way of getting around in other countries. It's just and pointing to the crime and the type of criminals that we seem to be having in this country now. I mean, people that will kill you for nothing. I mean, really, for nothing. And maybe just the joy of doing it, you know, and far worse can happen to you out there as well. So I wouldn't recommend it for an uncivilized country like the United States, but perfectly acceptable.
Well, that reminds me of meeting an Australian traveler coming to the United States, and he traveled much as I did. He would arrive in New York City in this case and just walk around. Well, he walked into a not-so-safe neighborhood, and he was about to be mugged. But as soon as they heard his Australian accent, they put him in a different cultural context. He wasn't the bad American, and they let him go.
And I have noticed that.
Trust me when I tell you, New York, that doesn't work with a Southern accent.
but I will tell you something that works with American travelers, and you know, American travelers will know each other from a distance, and you know, the Canadians as well will know the Americans from a distance, and. It used to be fairly popular to have one of those little American flag patches.
Mm-hmm.
However, those got dropped pretty much in the 80s and 90s in favor of all things the Confederate battle flag.
Yeah,
that, if you have one of those sewn onto your gear somewhere, folks go, oh, well, he's an American, but he's a rebel.
You know, I've told this story before, but I was getting ready to have dinner with, I guess, probably eight other people with Maggie Thatcher one time, and she says something about you Yanks and everything, and she hears me talk, and she leans over and says something about, well, I apologize for that, you know, we love you. Well, you're not a Yank. We know that. And I quoted Churchill about something like that. But that's exactly right. I actually had somebody from Australia tell me one time that they grew up in a village or a town that was settled by Confederate soldiers who had moved there after the war, and that that they thought that the Confederate flag was the American flag throughout most of their growing up and their life and everything. And of course, it also was used in England and Scotland and Ireland for people who like American rockabilly music and Southern roots type music over there. So it would be kind of weird being over there and seeing that, though, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely. To see the Confederate battle flag like that, it's like, hey, you know. But
of course, the cross of St. Andrews pretty much came from over there, so we took it from.
Well, I mean, you know, if you look at the Union Jack, it ain't much different.
Right.
You know, it's red, white, and blue, isn't it?
Right.
But the folks there, I mean, in most countries that I've been in, you know, when they hear my accent, which I don't really think that I have that much of one, but you know, they've pegged me for a Southerner, and I really don't think that I sound all that Southern, but. You know, it's like they were just mad for American Civil War history.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, well, you're from the South. Were there any battles for you?
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, yeah, well, let me tell you about the Battle of Knoxville, Siege of Fort Sanders.
You know, I'll never forget.
And then when I told them that Burnside actually won one against Longstreet, they went, what?
Yeah, it was very disappointing. You shouldn't have broke that to them. You know, first time I went to Canada, flew into Toronto at the time. I don't know if they still do. They had very strict blue laws. And the only thing was, everything was closed down. The only thing open was Colonel Sanders walked in, and I said, the girl came up the counter, and I said, how are you today? And she said, are you from Tennessee or Texas? And I said, Tennessee. And she said, do you know Johnny Cash? So it's not just the war, but it's something. Brian, thank you so much.
Okay, man.
Let's go to Thomas so he doesn't have to wait much longer. Thomas, how are you today?
I'm good. Good morning.
Good morning.
A couple of things for you. Hey, Kelvin, you could do something that my friend did one time. He sent an email out to everybody he knew and said, I want to go on a world travel. Please connect me to anyone you know that lives in any country other than the U.S.
Huh.
And believe it or not, he had about 20 different places that he was able to stay for free because of friends of friends of friends. So that's something to think about.
Yeah, I remember that.
That's one good thing to do. And then for your guest, this is a great show and good time to get away from politics, even though I'm in the middle of it. But I haven't read your book, and I'm going to get your book. But did you ever go down to South Africa?
Yes, I did.
And what did you go to Cape Town?
Yes.
What did you think of Cape Town? Now, I joined the show late, so if you've talked about this, I apologize.
No, I haven't. I was talking off air. Some friends put together some questions, sort of preparing me for a radio interview. And one of the questions that kind of stumped me was, what surprised you most traveling overseas? And that's a great lead-in for South Africa because, first of all, I wasn't prepared as I usually was because before getting into South Africa, I was traveling through Spain and Morocco, and I couldn't get a good guidebook for Southern Africa anywhere in those countries. So the only thing I really knew was what travelers were saying. When you get in Johannesburg, or as I say, Joburg, get out quick. It had become quite lawless, and I was quite afraid being a white person.
This was post-apartheid, obviously.
Yes, this was 1999 when I was there. So I was thinking, well, I get to the airport, I'm going to have to get a Kevlar vest and hire an armored vehicle or something like that. So I had these preconceptions that I would be the focus of a lot of unjustified animosity, hatred, and it was the exact opposite. I traveled throughout South Africa. I went into Soweto and the epicenters of racial oppression and apartheid. I traveled on the black taxis, which all the poor blacks travel, these overloaded Toyota minivans, and I never even received a single stare that I thought was threatening. And I was invited in homes, and it was so far from what I was fearing. You know, I thought that they would use the white skin to take back their grievances for apartheid, and as I say, tear me apartheid. But it was enlightening, very enlightening.
Now, out of all the places you've been, would you say that Cape Town may be one of the most beautiful places you've ever been?
Yes. Obviously, you went there, and you went there and you were impressed by it.
Yes, I was. I was trying to imagine. I was on top of Table Mountain, and I was looking out at the ocean there, and I was just trying to imagine when the first settlers came in, the white settlers came in to start to settle in South Africa, what they thought when they saw that, because you see that harbor and Table Mountain.
Oh, absolutely. Climbed up and rode the tramway up there as well. But like you say, a very pleasant, attractive city sandwiched in between Table Mountain, which looks like an impenetrable fortress with cliffs rising up above the city, and then the deep blue of the South Atlantic there. It's a gorgeous city, gorgeous. And the beaches there, although the water's cold because the current comes up from the south, from the Antarctic, you know, you don't think of a south current as being cold, but it is. But the beaches look tropical, as beautiful as any in the world.
Yeah, it's a great place. And Lloyd, I was going to tell you, in regard to your story you're talking about KFC and and people knowing you because Tennessee Johnny Cash, you know, I've got a pretty good accent here. And when I go out to anywhere in the world, people immediately know I'm from the South, and the first thing they say is, where are you from? And I say, Tennessee, and the first thing they say is Jack Daniels. People know Tennessee because of two things, Johnny Cash and Jack Daniels. Or they know it because of country music and the Grand Ole Opry.
And you know what? I exaggerated a tad bit and told her I'd just seen Johnny Cash before I left at the grocery store. But you know, you got to entertain these folks. Am I right?
That's right. And I also found it's amazing how much, like, Europeans, and last summer I was in, used to be, you know, Czechoslovakia, and that's the Czech Republic and Slovakia. And it was amazing how many people knew so much about U.S. history. And I was amazed that they probably knew more about U.S. history than the majority of our high school kids graduating.
Yeah, I used to run an organization called the South Foundation for the Preservation of Southern History. And many people, well, many, maybe a half a dozen or so, from other countries came and interviewed me about that. Of course, that's always been my specialty in politics, of Southern politics. And they have a better intellectual understanding of Southern culture and Southern history. Now, we may have more of an instinctive understanding of it, but they certainly, it is amazing to me and very impressive. Now, I've never been one of these guys. I don't know who got shot on what battlefield and what organ it pierced and what caliber the bullet was. I never have been able to remember stuff like that. I've always been concerned with you know, how the Revolutionary War started, why, and all that, and the war between the states and everything else. That's been my thing. But it is a pleasure to sit down and talk with some of these folks, and particularly folks who have been naturalized and now live here from another country. And they have a great love for talking American history, and that's a. I'm afraid I'm a little ashamed about the rest of us here that we don't you know, you have somebody that's 30 years old and you mentioned the Eisenhower administration. Well, I'm not responsible for that. I wasn't around then. Well, of course you're responsible for that. You need to know that. Thank you so much. I appreciate it, Thomas.
All right, see you. Bye.
Let's take a quick break. Ron Miller's with us. He's the author of Escape from the Happy Cannibal. We're glad he did.
Okay, if I'm making my first trip, where would you recommend?
Oh, the world is a big place, and first thing I would ask you a question is what do you want? You want a cultural experience? Do you want to see natural beauty? And sometimes you can get both. So give me a little bit
I'm
what you're looking for.
Is there any country that hands out free cigars and whiskey? Because that's really, that's really what he's looking for.
I'm thinking that I'd like to go, do first, you know, Western Europe and then mm-hmm. Eastern Europe,
mm-hmm.
or vice versa. If I'm going to Eastern Europe,
it's not a huge landmass. Hit them all. Although, that's one dig against American travelers. They're kind of looked upon as taking the McDonald's tour. You know, yeah. see everything, and you don't really experience the country. And
see,
I've never
been attracted to these tours that everybody. Yeah. On day one, we'll be visiting, beautiful Scandinavia. Mm-hmm. On day two, we'll be in Australia. And it always kind of bugs me about cruises too. You know, if you could get off somewhere and then catch another one coming back, it'd be kind of nice. You know,
let him answer my question, Lord.
Well, it's not about you, Kelvin. Yeah, it's about listeners, not about your trip to Europe that you've now decided you're going to go on.
Eastern Europe.
There was one when I arrived in New Zealand, probably the country most well known for hitchhiking. Mm-hmm. I actually went on a backpacker tour. You know, mm-hmm. you get in a bus and they try to go to the obscure locations and beauty sites out of the way. But the reason I did is because it was winter and the North Island's very wet and the South Island is cold and snowy. And I thought, well, it doesn't sound too comfortable. And I regretted that immediately because you travel around isolated in your own environment in the mm-hmm. bus. And you're not meeting the local people, which I probably valued as much as anything. But there is one side of it that can be interesting, which is you form a close bond with the people you're traveling with. And, mm-hmm. and I know a lot of seniors, when they go and travel, they probably enjoy that as much as, mm-hmm. as the local folks they meet. But
see, I don't wear name tags either, so yeah. That really bugs me too. I just refuse to wear name tags. Let's go to the phones and we'll come back to you. Well, go ahead, Kel. Go ahead.
What was the most adventurous country that you went to?
Good. Very good question. And the first trip, I think it was Nepal, because I went trekking through the Himalayas, and it was what I thought I was looking for going overseas the first time, which was the beautiful landscapes and to meet the people. It was a bit like a living outdoor museum, because the people lived off the land, their houses, they shaped the rocks and thatch, and they, mm-hmm. and they whatever they ate, they grew, other than what would be brought in for the trekkers going through the, mm-hmm. the villages and so forth. But the most adventurous would be, without question, traveling through sub-Saharan Africa. And I didn't travel with the backpacker tours or mm-hmm. so forth. I tried to meet the local folks, travel the black taxis, hitchhiking whenever I thought it was safe. And mm-hmm. and that was probably the most adventurous. And in fact, a powerful story in the book, it was the one time that my mother and brother came to meet me traveling. We went on safari in East Africa. Mm-hmm. My brother had met me a couple of times traveling, but my mother decided to come this time. And we went on a wonderful safari in Tanzania, then went and relaxed a little bit along the coast in Kenya, and then went over to Uganda. And our primary objective was to go trek and see the mountain gorilla. And it just happened to be the time when some Interahamwe rebels from across, originally from Rwanda, hiding out in Congo, wanted to come across into Uganda and make a political statement. They were looking for Americans, and we were there while they were hiding out in the bushes, and it's part of the story. A lot of the people that were in this small camp to see the mountain gorilla, just tourists out looking for a nice experience, ended up getting butchered to death with machetes and clubs.
Hmm. Lumpy, how are you
this
morning?
Country again?
Uganda.
Okay. doing good, Lloyd. And I've got a trip for Kelvin, and I guarantee no caning, no machete. Well, okay, maybe machetes, but not used on human beings, and no clubs.
Uh-huh.
My parents have agreed to host Kelvin on the island of Rumkey in the Bahamas. They've said that since he did such a good job portraying me in the front page Follies, that Kelvin can be Lumpy for a week and come down and visit the Bahamas.
Wow, Lumpy for a week. That's
Lumpy for a week. And, that's 10 days it would be a better trip. But, Kelvin, I tell you what, when it comes to cigars, there's a certain little embargo that they don't recognize in the Bahamas.
Okay, cool.
See, that sounds to me like more of a trip for you. Vic,
well,
what do you think?
I was going to offer the same thing. I was going to offer to let him stay a while in Campbell County,
mm-hmm.
and I'd take him up to Stinking Creek, USA.
Yeah.
We'd stroll across White Oak Creek and
is the
come down
monkey
through
still
Washburn.
There?
They haven't seen that thing in over a year,
really?
Which concerns me.
Yeah.
That for its safety.
Yeah.
But I could show you where the skunk monkey lived.
Mm-hmm.
while you're up there.
Beautiful Norris Lake.
Or was seen. I don't know where it was lived, where it was seen. Yeah, yeah. Beautiful Norris Lake. So yeah. I was going to offer to do that, so you're welcome to come up there. Okay. There's two offers already.
You could make it a whole southern tour, Kelvin. You could start in Campbell County and keep going south, drive down to Florida, drive through Georgia. I'm sure Lloyd has a lot of good restaurants for you to check out.
I got plenty of restaurants anywhere, any state in the south. I can show you where to eat.
I tell you what, this is what we're going to do. We're going to start a Kelvin Moxley Worldwide Travel Fund. Anybody who wants to make a contribution to get me out of the country.
Well, now, wait a minute. That's, we may have a telethon for that. We just overloaded the phone lines then. Hey, thank you, Luffy.
Thank you.
546-2148. Before we have to end here, and we could go on for some time, I'm sure. You change politically and culturally after you left America for the first time, but also I think if you go through the
book, we have my first donation here.
Just came in cash,
$500.
Wow. It affected your faith too.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, I grew up here in East Tennessee, and of course I was exposed to Christianity, churches, and so forth. But unfortunately for me, I wasn't going to find what I was looking for in churches. It wasn't the right venue or the right approach. And as I stated earlier, when I went overseas, what I didn't realize is I was looking for that guidance that should supersede culture. And eventually, what I was looking for is that relationship that Adam lost, which was with the Creator. And, you know, where is that? Where is that relationship? Where do we go to communicate with God? And ironically, I went all over the world looking for that link, and I carried it with me all the time. And that's the lesson that I had to learn.
Mm-hmm. And I guess to sum up about the book, and I want to tell folks how they can, if you want to get your write this down. We'll tell you how to get this book, and I think Vic just got an autographed copy of it. So
I've sold three copies here in the studio. Yes, really, it's really worth getting up this morning. Exactly. Thank you very much.
And how to do that? But really, this book is
you could live for a month on Nepal. Yeah. On that.
it's a travelogue. It's a spiritual journey, and it's a political awakening. Is that fair?
Yeah, one of my editors described it as cultural and spiritual travelogue, and I learned so much by being able to spend time in countries that ran the full range from economies and standard of living, from our affluent society to the most impoverished countries, and the freedom we have here in the United States versus tyrannical societies. And I was always asking why. As if maybe there was a root cause, and like Einstein said when he was asked about his intelligence, his genius, he said, "It's not that I am so smart; it's simply that I stay with problems longer." And and I think very similarly, that was my experience with culture. And you know, not that I'm a genius like Einstein, although if your listeners want to make that link, that's all right; I don't mind. But I was always asking why. And receptive to the little clues that would come along, and I think I've uncovered the root cause for tyranny, poverty, and racism.
We're gonna take a call from Kev, but before we do, so we don't run out of time, tell folks how to get the book.
Yes, the local bookstores have been very supportive. You can get it at Borders, at the Westtown location, and their new location in Turkey Creek. And I will be having a book signing at the Turkey Creek location on Saturday, July 8th. It's also available if you're in the Maryville area at Hastings Bookstore and at the Christian Bookstore, Cedar Springs, and the two Knoxville locations, Lifeway Christian Stores, Merchants Road. And if you're up in North Knoxville, Lost Avant, and in Bearden, Carpe Librum. But you can also get it at my webpage, which I welcome people to go to. I've got thousands of pictures from around the world, and that's at rontravel.com.
Let's go to Kev. Kev, I have to ask you to make it quick. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great. I just recommend to Calvin to travel the greatest country on the planet, and that's the United States. I've been across country, 6 round trips, been different routes all the way, and I really, grew to love this country, and I would recommend this country first, then hit those other pagan countries.
I'm just trying to get them into Vaughn nowhere. That's all I'm trying to do.
And my book is about what makes this country so great. That's a good point.
Kev, thank you.
Well, we sure do appreciate you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, we've really enjoyed having you, Ron. I'm sure hopefully you'll come back. So, are you working on another book, or is this it?
I'm a book peddler right now, but I probably have another book in me in the future.
Yeah. And once again, give us your website.
RonTravel.com. Thank you very much for inviting me in the studio.
Well, we appreciate you visiting with us. Folks, we're going to be back with the last hour of The Voice. You can go to SouthernRootsRadio.com, send us a message on the guest book. We'll be reading those next. Kelvin Moxley, Vic King will be with us. I think we're going to argue about Ann Coulter for a while. You're listening to Southern Roots Radio.